Okay, so I'm very honored and happy to be able to attend this Dharma Realm Buddhist University, and I understand that this will be like one of the first courses given here. Is that the case?
In this space.
In this space, yeah. Okay, so the topic that I'll be speaking about in this course is we call it the Theravada version of the Abhidharma, because there are actually several versions of the Abhidharma which have come down through the textual transmission. There is the Theravada version, which prevails in the Theravada school, which is a form of Buddhism that is practiced in Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos. Yeah, there was another school that put a lot of emphasis on the Abhidharma, called the Sarvastivada school, which prevailed in the early centuries of the Common Era. It prevailed in the northwest of India, in the area that's now Kashmir, and they had their own Abhidharma system, which is quite different from the Theravada version of the Abhidharma. When I try to read the Sarvastivada Abhidharma, I feel like I'm an English speaker, as I am, who suddenly found himself in Germany and trying to get around with his English in Germany. And then there seems to have been a third school of the Abhidharma, which was it spread in the far northwest, in the area that now corresponds to Pakistan and eastern Afghanistan. And they left an Abhidharma text, which is preserved only in Chinese. It's called, the reconstructed title is the Abhidharma, the Sariputra Abhidharma Shastra. I think it would be something like Sali for Abhidhamma Lun, something like that. Okay, but the significant difference between these three schools of Abhidharma is that the Sarvastivada school doesn't exist anymore. Its Abhidharma system is preserved mainly in Chinese translation, a few texts preserved in Sanskrit, maybe some Abhidharma commentaries in Tibetan, but there's no school which is practicing that form of Abhidharma. And the school that followed the Sariputra Abhidharma Shastra again vanished centuries ago. But the Theravada school still exists and still studies and practices the Abhidharma, even today. Okay, now first coming into the Abhidharma, we should understand the source of the Abhidharma is in the Pali Canon itself. That is the collection of scriptures preserved in the ancient Indian language called Pali. And the Pali Canon is divided into three major sections, which is why it's also called the Tipitaka, or Sanskrit Tripitaka, the three collections or three baskets of teaching. So what are these three collections? There's first the Vinaya Pitaka, which is the collection which emphasizes the rules and regulations for the Sangha, the rules of monastic behavior, proper behavior, the regulations for performing the collective functions of the Sangha. So that's the Vinaya Pitaka. Then there is the Sutta Pitaka, which contains primarily the discourses of the Buddha and of some of his great disciples, like Sariputta, Mahakachana, Moggallana, Ananda, and so on. And then the third collection is the Abhidharma Pitaka. Now, we can pretty much infer that at least the original or more archaic parts of the Vinaya Pitaka originated from the Buddha himself. At least the rules and the regulations did. Probably most of the Sutta Pitaka originated from the Buddha himself. But where did the Abhidhamma originate? The Abhidhamma has a very, very different character from the Sutta Vitakka. It's not in the form of person-to-person discourses, but it takes the form of seven treatises, like philosophical treatises, which are extremely technical in their language, which use an extremely technical method of analysis and explanation, a kind of technical and very precise systematization of the Buddha's teachings. So where did the Abhidharma originate from? And here there is a significant difference of opinion between what we would call the Theravada tradition, the mainstream Theravada tradition, and modern scholarship. Okay, the Theravada tradition, as preserved in the Pali commentaries, says that the Abhidhamma originated as the text of the Abhidhamma, originated with the Buddha himself. They say that the Abhidhamma commentary says that the Buddha realized the Abhidhamma during the period after his enlightenment when he was still staying in the vicinity of the Bodhi tree. He stayed in the vicinity of the Bodhi tree for 49 days, and during this period it's said that he contemplated all of the details of the Abhidhamma as a complete and integral system. Okay, then the narrative continues. In the seventh year after the Buddha's enlightenment, he made a trip to the Tava-Tingsa, one of the heavenly worlds, expressly for the purpose of teaching the Abhidharma. And he did this because he wanted to repay the kindness of his mother. His mother, Mahamaya, passed away 7 days after he was born, and she was reborn in one of the Deva worlds. And so it's said that the Buddha went to the Tava-Tingsa, I think in Sanskrit, Triya-Tingsa, Deva world, in order to teach the Abhidharma to the Devas, making his mother the chief recipient of the teaching. But then it said that while the Buddha was teaching the Abhidharma in the heavenly world, each day, in order to sustain his body, he would come down to the human world, to a very obscure part around the area where I think Mount Kailash is, Lake Anuttata. This is, I think it's almost on the edge between India and Tibet. And Sariputta would go to that region each day, and the Buddha would tell Sariputta what aspects of the Abhidharma he had taught during the previous day. And then Sariputta was the one who took the teachings from the Buddha and then arranged them and set them into a textual form. So in this way, the Theravada tradition says that at least six of the books of the Abhidharma derive directly from the Buddha, coming from the Deva world, the Buddha's sojourn in the Deva world, and the summaries of the Abhidhamma that he taught to Sariputta. So that is the traditional view, but modern scholarship takes a different view. And according to modern scholarship, and I have to say I agree with modern scholarship, the Abhidhamma is a body of teachings which emerged through a gradual process of evolution. And to see how we get from the Nikaya teaching to the Abhidharma, I just collected some texts. Actually, I'd collected them some time ago, but I created this file this afternoon, realizing it would be easier to present it visually so you could see for yourself. Okay, the word Abhidhamma occurs in the Sutta Vitakka, in the collection of discourses, but we never see in the Sutta Vitakka a statement to the effect The Buddha was teaching the Abhidharma to the monks. We never find anything like that. But rather, the word Abhidharma always occurs in the context of discussions that monks are holding amongst themselves. And so to support this point, I've collected a few passages. Okay, so this is from Majjhima Nikaya, Sutta number 32. Here, the Venerable Mahamoggallana is speaking to Sariputta, and he's describing two monks are holding a discussion on Abhidharma. They ask one another questions, and they answer one another's questions, and they do not stumble in their discussion, and so their Dhamma discussion flows on smoothly. And so for those who know the Pali or are interested in Pali, we see the expression here that two monks are discussing an Abhidhamma discussion or holding an Abhidhamma discussion. Okay, another passage. Okay, in this passage it says that several elder monks had assembled after their meal and they were sitting, holding a discussion on the Abhidhamma. And then there was one rather irritating monk named Citta Hatti Sariputta who kept on interrupting the discussion of those elders as they discussed the Abhidhamma. And then another statement I took from Anguttara Nikaya. Okay, when a monk is asked a question about the Abhidhamma or the Abhivinaya, he answers and he does not stumble in his conversation. So from this, it seems that we can draw the inference that Abhidhamma meant discussions about the Dhamma that took place between the monks. And probably these discussions would have taken the form of monks sort of testing one another by asking one monk asking the other questions, and then the other having to answer those questions. And probably as time went by, those questions and discussions became increasingly more technical and analytical. So whereas the Buddha was principally a practical teacher who was out to teach extensively in readily comprehensible terms, the path to liberation from suffering. The monks, even during the Buddha's time and later generations, started to explore the implications of his teaching and then to treat it in a more and more technical, analytical manner. Okay, so out of these discussions, over time, there would have evolved a new body of teachings, more detailed and technical than the discourses of the Buddha himself. And so it was these additional teachings, more technical teachings, which came to be called Abhidharma. But we can already see in the Nikayas, the collections of the Buddha's suttas, certain trends that are pointing in the direction of this more technical, analytical method of teaching. So I've collected several passages which illustrate this. So these, I call these tendencies towards the Abhidharma that could be found in the Nikayas, that is, in the suttas. And interestingly, several of these passages involve Venerable Sariputta. And so when later generations see Sariputta as the kind of formulator of the Abhidhamma, even though that might be an exaggeration, but Sariputta, his manner of teaching seems to have planted the seeds out of which the Abhidhamma developed. Okay, so here we have a passage. This is Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 28. This is the longer discourse on the elephant's footprint simile. So Sariputta is speaking to the monks, and he says, when the eye is intact and external forms come into its range, and there is the corresponding act of attention to those forms, then there is a manifestation of the corresponding type of consciousness. Okay, so now we have an act of consciousness, an occasion of consciousness, and now Sariputta is going to locate in that occasion of consciousness the presence of the five aggregates. So he says, the material form in what has thus come to be, that is included in the material form aggregate. I think probably all of you are familiar with the five aggregates. Anybody doesn't know what the five aggregates are? Okay, good. Of course, if you raise your hand, I have to say, go back to elementary Buddha Dharma. Okay, so we have material form, the feeling that is present on that occasion, that's included in the feeling aggregate. The perception is included in the perception aggregate. The volitional formations included in the volitional formations aggregate. And the consciousness itself goes into the consciousness aggregate. So that is how there comes to be this classification of dharmas into the five aggregates. So this is almost like a starting point of the Abhidhamma that we see develop much more extensively in the first book of the Abhidhamma called the Dhammasangani. Okay, here is another sutta. And in this case, it's the Buddha speaking, but he's speaking about Sariputta, about the way Sariputta practiced meditation in order to reach his final goal, to attain arahatship. So he says that, and this is the standard formula for the first jhana, or in Sanskrit, the first dhyana. He says that quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, Sariputta entered and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Okay, that is the standard formula for the first jhana that occurs like 1,000 times in the Sutta Pitaka. But then the Buddha adds something else. He says, the states that were present in the first jhana, then he enumerates them, the applied thought, sustained thought, rapture, pleasure, unification of mind, contact, feeling, perception, volition, and mind, zeal, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention. These states were defined by Sariputta, each one as they occurred. And he knew those states when they arose. He knew them when they were present. He knew them when they disappeared. Okay, so this is the way, it's showing the way Sariputta investigated, looked into this meditative state of the first jhana, and then was able to distinguish in that state the different constituents, the mental components, to break that state down a little bit the way scientists, when they get the atom, then they break the atom down into the subatomic particles. Okay, so these kinds of suttas, which take an analytical approach, can be seen as a kind of root out of which the Abhidhamma developed. Another source, and this comes from the Buddha himself, are suttas. They're called Vibhanga suttas. The word Vibhanga means analysis. And so we find scattered in the Sutta Pitaka a number of suttas which analyze the main themes or topics of the suttas. So in this sutta from the Saṅyutta Nikāya, the Buddha is speaking about the five aggregates. So what are the five aggregates? Whatever form there is, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, this is called the form or material form aggregate. And so the same way the feeling aggregate, perception aggregate, the volitional formations aggregate, the consciousness aggregate. Okay, so this is a kind of analysis or explication of the five aggregates, each one defined in the same way. Okay, some other examples. I didn't take quotations, but it's enough just to refer to them. We have a sutta that provides an analysis of the links of dependent origination, Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 12, number 2. An analysis of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, an analysis of the four foundations of mindfulness, an analysis of the five spiritual faculties. Yeah, so these are some analytical suttas. Okay, now I just quoted above, okay, that analysis of the five aggregates that we find in the suttas, but in the suttas, we don't find explanations of these terms, past, future, present, internal or external. They're just left understood. But this is what is taking place in an Abhidharma text. This is an Abhidharma text called the Vibhanga, the Book of Analysis. And so here we have the first chapter of this book of the Vibhanga is on the five aggregates. And here it repeats the formula. I just took the Pali, but it's easy to follow. So this is the definition of the material form aggregate that we just read in English from the sutta. So then the Vibhanga raises the question, what is meant by form that is past? And it gives a definition. What is meant by form that is future? And you see it has a whole string of terms. Form that is past, that is stopped, that is gone, that is vanished, that is passed away. You know, there are more words in Pali for things that are past and gone than in English. Okay. Future, present. What is meant by form that is internal? So the form that belongs to the different types of living beings, their personal form, their own form, their individual form, their acquired form, the four great elements and the material form based on the four elements, that is called internal form. And similarly, analogously for external form, gross and subtle, inferior and superior, far and near, each one is given an extended definition. So it's a little bit like a technical textbook for understanding the suttas. Okay, another source for the Abhidhamma, it's said according to the Western scholars is, before I come to that point, this is my own conjecture or speculation that the Abhidhamma would have developed particularly out of one of the Nikayas, one of the four or five Nikayas in the Sutta Pitaka. Does anybody have any guess what that Nikaya is? Somebody who's familiar with the Nikayas? Say it. No, say it again. Not Anguttara, no. No, not the Majjhima. There are two left. Right, exactly the Samyutta Nikaya. And now I want to show you something that's interesting. Okay, this is a comparison, a little table that I prepared this morning, showing in one column, this is the Vibhanga, the second book of the Abhidhamma Vitakka, and this is the Samyutta Nikaya. And in my supposition, the Vibhanga is probably, or at least parts of the Vibhanga, are the oldest part of the Abhidhamma Vitakka. And here we could see the chapters laid out in the Vibhanga. Analysis of the five aggregates in the Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 22, is a big chapter on the aggregates. Analysis of the six sense bases, Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 35, same topic. Vibhanga, analysis of the four or six elements or 18 elements, chapter 14, same topic. Vibhanga, chapter 4, analysis of the Four Noble Truths, Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 56, on the Four Truths. And so for the faculties, dependent origination, the foundations of mindfulness, the right efforts, the basis of spiritual power, factors of enlightenment, factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, each one has a corresponding chapter in the Samyutta Nikaya. Okay, another source now for the or kind of root out of which the Abhidhamma would have developed was a group of teachings that is referred to in the suttas called the Matika. Maybe I should write that word on the board. Okay, the Pali word is matika. The Sanskrit is it matrika, Lauren? With yeah, I think it's this. But anyway, it's easier to pronounce if we do it this way. Otherwise, you have to do that rolling R. Matrika. Does anybody know what this word means? Or the origin of this word? And you don't have to know Pali or Sanskrit to know the meaning. It's exactly. It's exactly like the English word matrix. And does anybody know... Where, in fact, I wasn't thinking of that, but that is right. Where the word matrix, what it's related to. What is that? I'll give you a hint. It's a member of the family. Exactly, exactly. Probably in a European language, it might be clearer. But anyway, it's clear enough in English. And what does a mother do? I mean, initially, to become a mother. What does a woman do to become a mother? Gives birth to children, right? So a matrika is a kind of outline of the teaching from which one can generate other aspects of the teaching. Just like a mother gives birth to children, so the matrika is a way of summarizing the Dhamma and condensing it into a list, then out of that list, one could get children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. To give you an example, here's a matrika. We have, okay, the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. I translate that as the aids to enlightenment, the factors contributing to enlightenment. We have the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four bases for spiritual power, the five faculties, five powers, seven factors of enlightenment. Noble Eightfold Path. Let's take Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, let's see how we get children out of this. Okay. From the different factors, I'm going to take right mindfulness. Okay, so this is the mother. Well, actually, this is the mother. This is the child, the Noble Eightfold Path. Right mindfulness is the grandchild. And then, does anybody know how the suttas explain right mindfulness? I'm sure you've come across it. Give you a hint. What? Yeah, okay, but we'll say the general. Right, the four foundations of mindfulness. I just use this abbreviation. Four foundations of mindfulness. So what are they? Feelings. States of mind. And then we have something hard to translate. It's called dhammas. Okay, now this is the test gets where we separate the diligent ones. In the dhammas, contemplation of dhammas, what do we find? Excuse me? You have to be familiar with the sutta. No. Okay. Did you say that? Okay. We have five hindrances. What else? Okay, five aggregates, six sense bases, seven factors of enlightenment, and four noble truths. What is that? I'm not hearing.
Five roots and five powers.
No, not in the foundations of mindfulness. But we do have those five, what you call the five roots or five faculties and five powers in the 37 factors of enlightenment. Okay, so here, out of the 37, we're taking one and we're generating right mindfulness. This gives rise to four foundations of mindfulness. Then we get body, feelings, mind, dhammas. And from dhammas, we get five hindrances. Then we could draw out five more factors from that. And so in that way, just from the Noble Eightfold Path, we're getting this comprehensive overview of the entire teaching. Okay, so this now covers, at least to the extent that I wish to cover it, the way in which the Abhidhamma would have grown out of the Nikayas. So we see this analytical trend in the Nikayas, particularly associated with Venerable Sariputta. We see these analytical suttas, the Vibhanga suttas, which get expanded upon in the Abhidhamma. The topics get expanded upon, and we see these matikas, these sort of outlines of the teaching or matrices from which one can derive rather complicated, complex strings of teachings. Okay, now I want to bring up, to look at the Abhidhamma from a different angle, and that is to point out certain continuities between the practical teachings of the Nikayas and the more theoretical teaching of the Abhidhamma. Sometimes it's said particularly by certain types of meditative monks or even certain scholarly monks, that the Nikaya teaching or Sutta teaching is practical and the Abhidhamma is just abstract theory. That doesn't have any practical significance. But in fact, the Abhidhamma teaching, even though it goes into a lot of analytical, maybe too much analytical detail, but it's still, that analysis is still subordinate to the guiding aim of the Buddha's teaching. And what is the guiding aim of the Buddha's teaching, the way it comes, the early teaching, the way it comes in the Nikayas, in the Pali, in the Sutta collections? The aim is to gain liberation from samsara, release from samsara, from the cycle of birth and death. And according to the Buddha, the sort of driving force behind the cycle of birth and death is craving. So it's that craving to go on enjoying and experiencing through the senses that drives the stream of consciousness from life to life in samsara. But what is it that underlies craving? What is the more fundamental mental affliction or defilement that underlies craving, sort of the root of the whole chain of conditionality? Exactly. Say that again. Ignorance. In Pali, we call it avijja, in Sanskrit, avidya, which means the absence of correct knowledge, the absence of correct cognition, the absence of clear, penetrative insight into the nature of things. And so the antidote to ignorance, the medicine for curing ignorance, is in Pali panya, in Sanskrit prajna, Chinese zhihui. And so this is wisdom or vijja, correct cognition, or the knowledge and vision of things as they really are. And so what is this right cognition or right understanding of things as they really are? It's understanding the nature of phenomena, the nature of dharmas. And so we can say that the Abhidharma, from one angle, is presenting a very, very broad, even a totalistic perspective on what are the dharmas, the phenomena, that have to be understood with wisdom. And how do those phenomena, how do they occur? What is their nature? What is their mode of occurrence? And what are their relationships, the interrelationships between the dharmas? And so, one angle, the Abhidharma aims at laying out a kind of palette, on a clear palette, the phenomena that have to be penetrated through insight wisdom. And it's said that those who develop very, very precise levels of insight knowledge are able to see the phenomena that are laid out in the Abhidharma teaching. Okay, then from another angle, the task in following the Buddha's path is to uproot or to eliminate the barriers or the obstacles that prevent one from gaining liberation. And those obstacles are what we call, usually we call them the kilesas, or Sanskrit, the klesha. So those are the mental afflictions or defilements. And so one of the projects undertaken in the Abhidharma is to lay out again in great detail and with precise, technically precise definitions, what are those defilements that have to be overcome. And then in following the Buddha's path, we have to know what are the things to be developed, to be cultivated in order to gain liberation. And so these are the things that are usually comprised in the 37 aids to enlightenment. And so one of the projects that the Abhidharma undertakes is to expound and to explain in detail and to define, to precisely define each of these 37 aids to enlightenment. And so even though this, we could say that the sutta has a pragmatic or practical orientation, and the Abhidhamma is more theoretical, but in its theory, what the Abhidhamma is doing is trying to establish a theoretical model that can accommodate all of the sutta teachings and show how they are interrelated and fit together into this path to liberation. Because in the suttas, you see, usually we find, if you look at the Sutta Pitaka, you see the Buddha doesn't give a very broad, comprehensive overview of his entire teaching in the abstract. But usually he directs the teaching to individual people and presents it from multiple points of view, from a wide variety of points of view. And if we just read the suttas, we could get confused, not knowing what is the appropriate point of entry into them. But when you study the Abhidhamma, then you can see how all of these pieces that constitute the suttas fit together into this very grand model of an analysis of the nature of experience, an uncovering and revelation of the underlying causes of bondage and suffering, and a clear description of the sequential path to liberation. Okay, maybe at this point I should ask whether there are any questions on what I've covered so far. Why is everybody laughing? Please.
The Mati.
Yeah, I think it's good always to use that.
Is it on? Okay.
Yeah.
The Matika are elements in the suttas, or is a certain category, or what exactly is it?
Okay, the Matika. Yeah, well, first I should say that in the suttas, we don't really have explanations of what the matikas are, but certain suttas praise a monk who is learned in the Vinaya, learned in the Dhamma, in the suttas, and one who upholds the matikas. But the matikas are not explained, but the word is taken to mean in outlines or summaries of the teaching. And then later in the Abhidhamma, then we find explicit matikas, rather complex matikas, which I'm going to come to, hopefully, either today or Wednesday. Okay, any other questions? Okay, with the blue shirt in the back. Please take the microphone so I could hear, so everybody can hear.
It may not be that important, but you you were saying that ignorance sort of keeps us driven into craving. But is ignorance here the same as delusion, or is there a reason to separate the two at that point? Or
yeah, actually, the two, technically, they are the same.
Okay.
And this is one of the things that the Abhidharma does, is to take these terms from the suttas, where you have different terms, and it draws them together so you could see which terms are actually really referring to the same thing under different names. In the suttas, the two terms are used, ignorance, which is avijja, and delusion is usually a translation for moha. So the two are used in somewhat different contexts, even though they're referring to the same thing. Ignorance is used when speaking about the dependent origination, that is the chain of causes that lead into rebirth and samsara. And delusion is used in more psychological contexts when speaking about the unwholesome states of mind that arise. But they're just, in a sense, two terms for the same mental state.
And is there any place where you have, in writing what you just summarized in the last 10 minutes, the practical either purpose or value of the Abhidhamma, that it's still very much directed towards liberation or overcoming suffering? I found that very helpful. My brain is about to explode because I couldn't get all of it.
I have these notes. I can make these notes available at some point. So I don't know whether the school could share them with people who registered for this course. Though I might, in fact, I recommend the introduction to this comprehensive manual of Abhidhamma, which also deals with the same issue, maybe from a different point of view. Or in different words, but it's it's the same book actually. Just that's the American edition. I have the old Sri Lankan edition. Okay, if there's no further questions, and nobody, we won't take a break. I'm getting warmed up. When are we supposed to stop? Oh, we have until 5:30.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So then maybe we take a little break. I thought it was 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock. Or maybe we just go on.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, now I want to deal with what I call the Abhidharma method. And here I've laid out in my outline what I call three main features of the Abhidharma method. Okay, first I'll mention what they are, and then I'll elaborate on them. The three main features, first, is what is called or known as the Dhamma theory. The second is an attribute matika. And the third is a detailed map of states of consciousness. Okay, so that's like the three main topics or three main features of the Abhidharma method. Okay, first, what is called the Dhamma theory, and this is going to be a little bit difficult section, so I warn you in advance. So, keep your heads cool. If you feel I'm about to explode, maybe we should pass some ice around. Okay, so the Dhamma theory is basically a postulation that our experience of the world can be reduced to a number of constituent mental and material phenomena, which are constantly arising and passing away. There's one exception to that, arising and passing away. Okay, so these dhammas, these fundamental phenomena, are said to be what is ultimately real. Those are the basic building blocks of experience, the basic building blocks of our experience of the world. And our usual way of dealing with the, we're not actually perceiving the dharmas themselves, the fundamental constituent factors of experience. But usually we are living in the realm of what would be called conventional reality or constructed reality, mentally constructed reality. And the mental constructs in which we live and with which we deal, these are constructed out of the bare constituent factors of experience. I'm going to give some illustrations of this to make it more comprehensible. So usually we deal in the realm of concepts, conceptual reality, constructed reality, mentally constructed reality. And those mental constructs are built up upon a foundation or substratum. And that substratum consists of those fundamental realities, the momentary mental and material phenomena. And so let me take an example. So we say that I'm holding a cup. Okay, now this cup, you know, it's for, in our conventional way of speaking, it's perfectly real. It's absolutely real. It's not a figment of my imagination. I'm holding it up. You could see it has water. I can take a sip of water. The water doesn't come flowing out from the cup. And if I hold it up, everybody can see the cup, right? Okay, but in the Abhidharma way of thinking, the cup is a conventional reality, a constructed reality. It's a concept. But what is here actually at the level of the dharmas? At the level of the dharmas, there is the property of hardness, that is the earth element. There is the property of cohesion, that which binds the particles, of the ceramic particles together. That is, according to the Abhidharma, that's the function of the water element or liquid element. There is a certain temperature. When I touch it, it's a little bit cool. That is the heat element. So compared to my body has a higher degree of the heat element than the cup, so the cup feels cool. But that coolness is a kind of negative degree of the heat element. And even though I don't perceive it, but the particles that make up the cup are constantly going through, constantly vibrating. So that vibration or movement, that is the activity of the air element or wind element. So there are these four primary elements that are present. And then based on those four primary elements, the most conspicuous secondary feature is the color, this kind of green color. So that is also a dharma. And the cup will also have In the Abhidhamma way of thinking, it will also have an odor, it will have a taste, though I'm not going to bite into the cup. And there'll be a whole bunch of other sort of properties of the cup which are considered dharmas. So these dharmas are adhering together and constituting the cup. And even though the cup appears to us, to our perception, to be something persisting, remaining the same through time, but at the level of, you know, somebody with very deep insight, perception into the cup, would see that the cup, the particles of the cup, that the cup is really a process of becoming, that the factors that make up the cup are constantly arising and passing away with incredible rapidity. It's a little bit almost anticipating like the discoveries of modern physics, that what we call a solid matter is made up of atoms, the atoms are made up of subatomic particles, and those subatomic particles are just forms of energy, constellated forms of energy. Okay, and the same would apply not only to physical matter, but to what we call the mind. So the mind is a composite. You know, we think that we have the same mind, the single persistent mind, from birth until death. But according to the Abhidhamma, what we call the mind is a sequence or series or process of momentary acts of consciousness. Always one moment of consciousness is arising, then it's ceasing, followed by another moment of consciousness, ceasing, followed by another moment. And each of those moments of consciousness brings together a multitude of mental factors that arise together with the consciousness. A feeling, a perception, the act of attention, some volition or intention, and many other mental factors. We're going to get acquainted with them as we go through this course. Yeah, we see. Yeah, I had some comments on the Dhamma theory. Maybe I'll just read some highlights from this. Okay, so this Dhamma theory, it starts from the premise that to attain the wisdom that knows things as they really are, the true and accurate wisdom, we have to be able to distinguish between those types of entities that have genuine reality, genuine actuality, and those are the Dhammas, and those types of entities that exist only as conceptual constructs. And the distortion in understanding, according to the Abhidhamma, is that we mistakenly grasp upon the concepts and take them to be ultimately real. And probably the most pernicious or harmful of those conceptual constructs, according to the Buddha's teaching, is the concept of myself, or the concepts of I and mine. So the Buddha teaches that the concepts of I, mine, and self, they're useful just as means of communication, as conventional terms. But when we take the idea self to be ultimately real, and we take the ideas of this is I, this is mine, to be pointing to genuine realities, then we fall into the trap of ignorance or delusion. And so when we see into the nature of our own experience and see that our experience is constituted of these dharmas that are arising and passing away, mental and material phenomena, and we look within them, where is the self? We don't find the self. The suttas compare this to, there's a story about a king who had never heard the sound of a veena before. The veena is the Indian lute. And so he heard the sweet sound of the veena, and so he asked his men, his attendants, bring me, he said, where is that sound coming from? And so the men said, that sound is the sound of a veena. And he said, bring me the veena. And so the men went and got the veena and brought him the veena. And he looked at the veena. He didn't see any sound there. So he thought, where is the sound? Then he took the veena apart, looked into it, and no sound. And he told the men, you've been deceiving me. You told me that that was the sound of a veena, but I took the veena apart, and there's no sound here. So in that way, we look for the self. You know, superficially, the self seems to be so clear, so evident. Everything that I do, everything that I think, everything that I wish for, it's all coming from this idea of myself. But when we investigate for and try to find it, all we see are bodily form, feelings, perceptions, the mental formations, consciousness. So that is the way of investigation. And what the Abhidharma does is to analyze all of those constituents again into detail and define them very precisely and to show how they interact. Okay, there are two ways to look at the Dhamma theory. Okay, one is to see it, and this is the more traditional way, the sort of more conservative way, and that is to see it as an attempt to create an exhaustive and accurate description of the contents of the world, to provide a kind of inventory of all of the phenomena of the world, and to see it as in all respects absolutely accurate and infallible. So that is the very conservative Theravadan sort of orthodox view, that the Abhidhamma speaks about 89 types of consciousness, and so there are exactly 89 types of consciousness. It speaks of 52 mental factors. There's exactly 52 mental factors, not 51, not 53. Okay, so that's one way. And in that case, the Abhidhamma, the Dhamma theory turns into a kind of metaphysical theory. Okay, the other way to look at the Dhamma theory, the way that I prefer, is to see it as a guide to insight and practice, not to grasp upon it as being absolutely infallible, but to see it as a kind of, maybe as a map rather than as a photograph. And maps can be sometimes defective, they're not perfectly, they don't represent the landscape perfectly. And so we can see that the Abhidhamma is laying out the things that have to be investigated with insight, laying out the defilements that have to be eliminated, the factors of the path that have to be cultivated, but don't take it absolutely literally as a photograph of reality. Because all attempts to photograph reality will be like when you develop the picture, there'll be distortions and blurs. and omissions in the photograph. Okay, so the first main feature of the Abhidhamma is the Dhamma theory. The second factor is, or the second feature of the Abhidhamma method is what is called the attribute matika. And this is the, again, we have that word matika. And this is an attempt to collect into a list the important qualities that can be ascribed to the dharmas, to the constituent phenomena. They're ways of dividing up these constituent phenomena according to certain categories. And we find the basic attribute matika of the Abhidhamma. It's laid out in the first book of the Abhidhamma. The book is called the Dhamma Sangini. And to give you an idea of some of these, how this attribute matika works, I made some selections. Where are they now? Ah, okay, they're here. Okay, so this is the attribute matika of the Dhamma Sangini. And what the attribute matika consists of 22 triads. Triad is a group of three. So these are three categories in which everything can be classified into one or another of these three categories. And so here we have the first set of categories are things that are wholesome, karmically wholesome, things that are unwholesome, things that are neither wholesome nor unwholesome. So everything, all phenomena are either wholesome, unwholesome, or neither wholesome nor unwholesome. A second triad, a group of three terms, things that are associated with pleasant feeling, things that are associated with painful feeling, things that are associated with the feeling that's neither painful nor pleasant. I've just took a few of the more interesting ones at random. Okay, things that are to be abandoned by insight, by seeing the truth. Things that are to be abandoned by developing, by cultivation, by cultivating the wisdom that arises with the initial insight. And things that are not to be abandoned either by insight or by cultivation. Okay, third set of terms. So these are limited phenomena, sublime phenomena, sublime states, and immeasurable states. Okay, another triad will be inferior dhammas, middle level dhammas, sublime or excellent dhammas. And then things pertaining to the past, things pertaining to the future, things pertaining to the present. So the way things fall into the three periods of time. So these are just a selection from the 22 triads. Then there are 100 dyads. The dyad is a set of two terms. It's a kind of on-off switch. So something is either one or the other. So here we have, I took just a few at random, things that arise through conditions, things that don't depend on conditions, phenomena that are conditioned, phenomena that are unconditioned, phenomena that are visible, things that are not visible, things involved in sense experience, things not involved in sense experience, things that are involve material form, things that are without material form, things that are mundane. This is the shujendafa, I think. Correct? Okay. And this is chushujendafa. This is the lokutra, world-transcending phenomena. Okay, so at the beginning, this work, the Dhamma Sangani, it lays out this matika. And then in a later chapter of the Dhamma Sangani, then it will fill in that matika, that kind of table of contents, by enumerating all of the phenomena that fit into each of these categories. Okay, then we come to the third feature of the Abhidhamma that I've, distinctive feature of the Abhidhamma that I've worked out. And this is an extensive classification of states of consciousness. So in the Nikayas, in the suttas, the Buddha lays extreme emphasis on the importance of the citta, the mind. And just to get some taste of the role of citta in the suttas, and to see, this will show us why the Abhidharma places so much emphasis on citta, and it makes the citta, the mind or the state of consciousness, the focus for its whole analysis of experience. So here we have some passages, just kind of selection of passages from the suttas. So here the Buddha says that he does not see even one other thing that when it's undeveloped and uncultivated leads to such great harm as the mind. And again, he does not see even one thing that when developed and cultivated leads to such great benefit as the mind. Again, he doesn't see one thing that brings so much suffering as the mind, and he does not see anything that when it's cultivated brings such happiness as the mind. Then the Dhammapada, famous Dhammapada, says, whatever harm an enemy might do to an enemy, a wrongly directed mind will do greater harm for oneself. And neither one's mother, father, or any other relative can do greater good than a well-directed mind. Okay, then he speaks again in the Dhammapada that it's wonderful to subdue the mind, to tame the mind. A tame mind brings happiness. He says, let the discerning person guard the mind. The guarded mind brings happiness. Okay, so even in this life, you could see that it's the citta, the mind, that is the source of either harm and suffering or well-being and happiness. And in order to avoid that suffering and to experience that happiness, one has to subdue the mind, guard the mind, develop and cultivate the mind. And then the citta also is what determines our destiny in future lives. So here's a sutta which says that it's because of the corruption of the mind or the defilement of the mind that after death, beings are reborn in a bad destination in the lower world, even in hell. And it's because of mental purity that with the breakup of the body after death, beings are reborn in a good destination, even in the heavenly world. And then it's ultimately, it's the mind that is liberated. So the mind is what is held, the citta is what is held in bondage. And then when one gains the liberating wisdom, it's the citta that's liberated. So here I took a passage that occurs very often in the suttas, that when one knows and sees the Four Noble Truths as they really are, then the mind is liberated, chitang vimuchati. It's liberated from the defilement of sensual craving, from the craving for existence, from the taint of ignorance. So therefore, the Buddha emphasizes, he says, it's important to know one's own mind. He says it's not so important to be skilled in knowing the minds of others. So some meditators who gain the shentong, the iddhis, superpowers, can read the minds of others. But the Buddha says that's of secondary importance. What is of first importance is to be skilled in knowing the ways of one's own citta, one's own mind. And then he explains, how do you know the ways of your own mind? So then you should ask yourself whether you're often given to longing, that's craving, or without craving, given to ill will, without ill will, and so on. This is the Anguttara Nikaya, Book of Tens, number 51. Okay, so what we find in the Abhidharma, developed in the Abhidharma, is a kind of map, much more detailed, much more analytical or classification of all of the different possible, at least according to the Abhidharma. I can think of many other states of consciousness of mine, not in the Abhidharma. But for practical purposes, one could see find in the Abhidharma this, I call it a topography of consciousness. So the topography of a territory or a region is a description of that region. Where are the mountains? Where are the rivers? Where are the plains? Where are the towns and villages and cities? And so the Abhidharma is developing this topography of the mind, or a typology of the mind, classifying the different types of cittas that can arise. And it uses different schemes of classification. The unwholesome cittas, the wholesome cittas, indeterminate cittas, the different functions of the cittas, the different objects of the cittas. And even though it might seem rather abstract, this map of consciousness, but again, we can look at it as being in agreement with the aims of Buddhist spiritual practice. And that is those aims of the Buddhist path that determine the shape of the map. So we could say that one of the aims of this map of consciousness is to show the unwholesome states of mind that we have to avoid because those states of mind result in suffering. They lead to rebirth in lower realms of existence, and they prolong our bondage in the round of rebirths in samsara. And again, the map of consciousness will show what states of mind create wholesome karma that will bring us happiness and well-being here and now in this present life, and that will lead to pleasant and desirable states of rebirth in our future lives. And then third, to show what are the states of consciousness, states of mind that can be developed in order to break our bondage to the entire cycle of birth and death and gain liberation. And so those are, you could say, the underlying program, or the program with the aims that underlie the map of consciousness that's developed in the Abhidharma. Okay, I think that covers this, my sort of introductory overview of the Abhidharma. So now I'll just throw the floor open for questions, and please feel free to ask any question that comes to your mind. But what I'll say is that if the question is relating to the material that we're going to be bringing up over the next couple of weeks, then I'll say be patient and wait till we get to a later class. Okay, please. Are there two? Yeah, are there mics on both sides?
Earlier, you mentioned about the example of a cup being a collection of properties.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. Earth and air and all of that. But is it how much is it the interaction of the properties?
Oh yeah, I mean that is extremely important
okay,
too.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. It's not that we just take these properties apart and see that they're existing sort of independent.
Yeah.
But actually, I mean, this is another aspect, another part of the Abhidharma project is not only to analyze the gross objects of experience into constituent elements, but the counterpart to this is the synthetic function, what the synthetic side of the Abhidharma, which is to show the relationships between these different properties. Just, I'll be jumping the gun into a very advanced topic in Abhidharma, which is conditional relations. But I'll just, to give you an example of this. So it's said that the four primary elements, the earth element, which is the property of solidity, the water element, the property of cohesion, the fire element, the property of heat, the air element, the property of motion. These are related to each other. The relationship is called anyamanya pachaya, which means that they are mutuality conditions for each other. That each of these elements is a supporting condition for the other three elements. But then again, it's said that the primary elements, those four primary elements, and the color are sahajata pachaya, which means co-arisen conditions for each other, that they arise simultaneously, but the four primary elements, the relationship between the four primary elements and the factor of color is not that of mutual conditioning, but rather the four primary elements are a strong condition for the color, but the color is not a strong condition for the four primary elements. They arise together and they support each other, they arise together. But the relation is not that of mutual conditioning, but there's a sort of stronger conditioning from the four elements to the property of color simile, the properties of odor, taste, if it produces sound. You know, so say a violin, when somebody is playing a violin or a guitar, the sound will arise simultaneously with the particular disturbance of the primary elements, and so they arise simultaneously, but the primary elements of the strings produce the sound, but the sound is not producing the primary elements of the string. Okay, other questions? Somebody on this side? Okay, please, please.
Hi, on the syllabus that we're given, the last thing we're supposed to discuss today is the way of the sphere and by way of quality. Could you elaborate what you've covered that is actually
Yeah, you see, I didn't get to that.
Oh, lovely.
I wanted to leave time for the questions.
Okay, just as long as I knew.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Finishing this up, I wanted to leave some time for the questions.
Could you explain what is meant with the Dhamma theory about those being real elements? I felt surprised by that, given that I thought there wasn't supposed to be anything that had reality.
Yeah, I think I'm going to come to that in the next session.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
It's a good question. It's a question that I've pondered too. And I have heretical opinions about that too. please, yeah.
Thanks for taking my question, Venerable. I was wondering about, you talked about the dharmas or the constituent elements, and then you talked about the citta, the mind.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about the relationship between these two. Are they always in a relationship, the citta and the dharmas?
The citta is a dharma, or let us say, any citta is a dharma. And again, that's something that we're going to come into in the next section. So maybe, unless somebody has an urgent question, maybe then we should proceed into the next section. Any urgent question? Okay.
Does
Okay, so we continue. Now I've sort of given a general overview of the origins of the Abhidhamma and the main features of the what we call the Abhidhamma project. Now we're going to come to the text, the actual text that we're going to be studying. Here we gave it the title, A Comprehensive Manual of Abhidhamma. And this is a translation with an explanatory guide, a translation of a little manual summary of the Abhidhamma, which was composed in Sri Lanka, perhaps the 11th or 12th century, called the Abhidhammata Sangaha. So to give some background to this work, I have to speak a little bit about the Abhidhamma literature, the Pali Abhidhamma literature. So the foundation of the Abhidharma in the Theravada tradition is the Abhidharma Bitaka. And the Abhidharma Bitaka consists of seven treatises. They're named Dhamma. You'll find them enumerated in the introduction to this book. Dhammasangani, Vibhanga, and so on. Okay, so those were the canonical. Those are the texts considered canonical in the Theravada tradition, like sacred scripture, considered to have come directly from the Buddha himself. But if you try to read an Abhidhamma text, oh, It's just so concise and abstract, almost like reading a telephone book. Do they still have telephone books with the cell phones now? I don't know. But in my days growing up, there was the telephone book. And so to make the texts of the canonical Abhidhamma text intelligible, there came into being a body of commentaries on the Abhidhamma. Maybe the commentaries were composed in Sri Lanka or coming, maybe some came from India into Sri Lanka and then developed in Sri Lanka, the 5th and 6th centuries. And so we have a big collection of Abhidhamma commentaries. And yet there are obscure points in the Abhidhamma commentaries. And so what happens? The next generation or 2 generations down, some very intelligent Abhidhamma scholars write sub-commentaries of the Abhidhamma. And maybe their pupils will write sub-sub-commentaries till you get this massive Abhidhamma literature. And then the young students, the young monks and nuns come into the Abhidhamma section of a library and they look at all of those books and they say, "Oh my God, you expect me to read that? No way." "I'm going to watch the World Series or the Super Bowl." So at some point, some elders learned it in the Abhidhamma thought, we have to do something to help the young students. And so they started to write what are called the manuals of the Abhidhamma. That is, taking this whole complicated system and reducing it into a format of 50 to 100 pages. And so, of those manuals of Abhidhamma, the one that's most popular in the Theravada world is the Abhidhammata Sangaha. But of course, the problem is that the Abhidhammata Sangaha is very concise. And so if you just read a translation, you can't understand nothing. And so that's why even in earlier centuries in Sri Lanka and Burma, the learned elders wrote commentaries to the manuals of Abhidhamma. And even I jumped into the game by writing the explanatory guide to the translation of the Abhidhammata Sangaha with the help of some Burmese, learned Burmese monks. Okay, so this is the work that we're going to be using as the basis for our study of the Abhidharma. And now I want to get into this work itself. And like almost all the commentaries in the Pali tradition, and probably in the whole Buddhist tradition, it opens with a verse of praise to the Triple Gem. So this is because the author wants to generate the merit to support him in his project of composing this work. So he writes a verse praising the Buddha as being the peerless one, praising the true Dhamma, and then praising the noble Sangha. And then he says he's going to compose this Abhidhammata Sangaha, which means Sangaha is like a summary, and Abhidhammata means the subjects of the Abhidhamma. Okay, so now we take the verse in section number 2. I have it on page 25. There are some little differences between the American edition and my old Sri Lankan edition. Okay, so let us look at this verse. Okay, and here it says that the things contained in the Abhidhamma, that is, the topics of the Abhidhamma, or the subject matter of the Abhidhamma, are altogether fourfold from the standpoint of ultimate reality. And what are those four things? We could first see them in the Pali language. Chittang, Chaitasikang, Rupang, Nibbanang. So Chitta is the mind. Chaitasika are the factors that arise associated with the mind. These would be factors like feeling, perception, volition, attention, and so forth. Rupa is matter, material phenomena. And then Nibbana is Nibbana, or Sanskrit Nirvana. Okay, this is the term that relates to the question that came up just a few minutes ago. The expression that's used here is paramattato. And here I have to confess that it's an expression I don't really like, but I'll explain how it derives. Okay, first let us do the word division. Yeah, wasn't there an eraser?
Oh. Wait a moment. That should work. Not a permanent marker. The White Walker? Okay, wait.
I think maybe a dry cloth. Yeah, that's better. Yeah, that should be enough room. We'll have to find a way to erase more quickly. I think it was very cool. Okay, the word parama means supreme or ultimate, the highest. And the word atta has several meanings in Pali and in Sanskrit. If anybody studies Sanskrit, it's the word artha. I was trying my Chinese, but I always... This is the top part. Oh, it's the character that looks like I. Oh, I'm not so good. I started to study Chinese too late in life. Okay, the word atta or artha in the suttas usually has the meaning either of the benefit that comes from something, the good of something, or the goal of an action. And another meaning in the suttas is meaning itself. So the meaning of a statement is its atta or artha. And we find that expression, paramatta, in the suttas used by the Buddha. But when the Buddha uses it, it's always in the sense of the supreme goal. So he's pointing always, like he's saying, that you should strive for the paramatta, for the ultimate goal, the supreme goal. The Buddha doesn't use the word or the expression paramatta to mean things that are ultimately real. But in the development of Abhidhamma thought, this word was sort of taken over, and then, or this expression was taken over, and the word atta came to have another meaning, and that meaning is simply that of things or entities. And I think artha has that meaning commonly in Sanskrit. So it was sort of the evolution of the word from meaning to the things that have meaning, to entities. So for the Abhidhamma thinkers, they say that these dharmas, these four types of dharmas, are paramattato. They're things that have, are ultimate entities, things that are ultimately real. I admit that I have trouble with the idea of ascribing ontological ultimacy to anything. But maybe we could see, instead of trying to take this in a rather abstract philosophical sense, we could take the sense, the meaning of paramatta as those things that are to be directly experienced in the process of contemplation with insight. And so as one is developing, sort of looking at it from a practical standpoint rather than a theoretical standpoint, when one is developing insight meditation or doing vipassana meditation, one is attending to the factors that constitute one's actual experience rather than to the conceptual entities that make up the conceptual world in which we normally live. So when I'm doing insight meditation, I'm attending with mindfulness to, say, my bodily movement. So I'm attending, in that case, to rupa, material form. What is present in my experience is material form. I'm not concerned now with the shape of the body, with designating the body, arms, hands, legs. Okay, so I'm not sort of conceptualizing the parts of the body, but I'm just attending to my actual experience of the form that's present in my experience. And then that form will manifest in various ways, sometimes as hardness. If I touch something, I will experience hardness, or I will experience maybe even in the body, flashes of heat or coolness or movement and vibration. So those are the things. And then as I observe the mind, there will arise different states of consciousness and different moods of the mind and different factors within the mind. So those are the actual objects of observation as opposed to the sort of conceptual entities that we normally deal with. Okay, so we see here that four entities or things, I'll put quotation marks around that word, things, are said to be the subjects that are dealt with in the Abhidharma. And now if we look at the sutta teaching, we see that the Buddha, usually when he's expounding on the nature of experience, he speaks about the five aggregates. The most common scheme of analysis is the five aggregates. So what is the relationship between these four so-called ultimates of the Abhidharma and the five aggregates? Okay, the first aggregate, what is the first aggregate? With my advanced age, my memory is getting bad. Form, right, material form. So we see that covered by rupa. Here it's translated as matter, but it's the same word. But then we have the next aggregate, feeling, perception, then the mental formations. Where do they go? What happened to them? Where are they? Those are the chaitasikas. The chaitasikas mean mental factors, the factors that go along with the citta, with the mind. And then the fifth aggregate is, in Pali, vijnana, Sanskrit, vijnana. In Chinese, it's shi, right? So that is what we translate the aggregate of consciousness. And that is represented here by citta. So even in the suttas, the Buddha sometimes says that which is called vijnana, citta, or mano. So the three things are taken to be synonymous, though they are used, the terms are used in different contexts. But here, the Abhidhamma system finds it easier to conduct its analysis of experience, taking citta as the primary object of analysis. And then the fourth entity of the Abhidhamma is Nibbana. Where is that in the five aggregates? Not there. Yeah, so Nibbana, the five aggregates are Lokiya, worldly or mundane phenomena. Nibbana is what transcends the world. So it's Lokuttara, or world transcending. Wait, chaitasika corresponds to what?
The sankharas, right? The mental formation.
Okay, she just asked me to review that correlation between the five aggregates and the four ultimates. Yeah, the chaitasikas include not only the mental formations, but the three intermediate aggregates. So feeling, perception, and the sankharas are considered chaitasikas. So chaitasika means, it's like originally an adjective based on citta. So that which pertains to the citta, that which is connected with the citta. And so the three mental aggregates, the three intermediate aggregates become the chaitasikas of the Abhidharma. And actually, in the oldest Abhidharma text, the scheme of the five aggregates is still dominant. But it seems that as the Abhidharma develops, then the scheme of the four ultimates becomes more prominent till it takes over. Probably because the scheme of the five aggregates has a practical orientation, since like one of the main things that one has to deal with in the meditation are the feelings that arise, pleasant feelings, painful feelings, neutral feelings, and then perceptions, which can lead into deluded views if one doesn't recognize them for what they are. So when one is dealing with the mind from a practical standpoint, it's useful to break it down into feeling, perception, the volitional activities, and then keep consciousness just as the bare awareness of the object. But because the Abhidhamma is becoming increasingly theoretical, so that distinction is no longer so necessary, so feeling, perception, and the volitional activities can all be grouped under the heading of the mental factors, chaitasikas. Okay, maybe if just there are any other questions, we'll take those questions. And then the discussion that I had slated for today, I'm very bad at keeping to my schedule, by the way. Yeah, the classifications of consciousness by way of sphere and by way of quality. We'll take that on, today's Monday, right? We'll take that on Wednesday. Okay, so it's 5:30 now, so I hope that because of this presentation today, on Wednesday, I see 4 or 5 people come to the class. Oh, yeah, good. If somebody, you have the question.
Yeah, again, sorry.
Never say I'm sorry for asking a question.
The difference in the Abhidhamma definitions between the atta, between attas and dhammas is what?
Pretty much the atta is the dhamma.
Okay.
Yeah. The atta, I would say that the attas are the dhammas. How do you end the class? Do you do it that way? Okay. Okay. I thought that this is a class, not a sermon, not a preaching, but we could do the sharing of the merits. Akasata chabumata. By the way, I could print that out and, or send you the file and then you could print it out for people to have. It has, the file has the Pali, the English, and the Chinese translation. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahidika punyantang anamoditva chirang rakantu mang parang etavatacham hehi sampadang punyasampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabbe bhutanumodantu sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya pavagupadaya avichihetato Etantare satakayupapana rupiya rupicha asanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibuting. Okay, so thank you all for your attention.